It's the Burt Cohen Show. Has changed a lot since its founding. There's a lot more technology there. It used to be just a printing press and a soapbox for people to be able to speak their minds and communicate. Now, boy, it's pretty amazing, and it can be overwhelming. The internet, it's big. It's affecting all of us, and I'm very pleased to have with us today a guy who I saw at my daughter's junior high school, actually, in Rye, speaking about, at the time he spoke about being digital citizens, raising conscious and compassionate media consumers in a handheld digital world. This is the second such discussion in a series about the internet and making it work for democracy, to keep our republic, to keep people in power, and to not have a big, giant corporate entity or two with all the power over us. Our guest today is Kevin Healy, Assistant Professor of Media Studies at the Communications Department at the University of New Hampshire. Kevin, thanks very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Bert. Thanks for having me on.
Well, in an essay titled, "You Are Not a Gadget," which is an interesting title, you write that our fascination with technology can become a religion unto itself, which may cost us something. Tell us what you mean by that. What examples do you see of this, and what might technology becoming a religion cost us?
That's a good question, and you can find evidence for it actually pretty easily. Ironically, if you go on Google and search for Mac heads or the cult of Mac, you can easily find visual examples of devotees of companies like Apple. I had a student this semester who did a paper on the cult of Apple. You can find examples of people shaving the logo of Apple into the backs of their heads, getting tattoos, talking about how they won't sleep with anyone who's a PC user, only Mac users. You can see visualizations of Steve Jobs as a kind of prophet holding iPads as tablets, almost like Moses on high. It's easy to find.
Ooh, that's a little scary. And what might having that as a religion cost us?
Well, in that chapter, I frame it as a kind of what I call technical idolatry. And what I mean by that is, now, of course, I'm adopting religious language there, which
sure.
I think is appropriate,
mm-hmm.
because in Silicon Valley, I do think that there's a tendency to think about technologies in ways that treat them as sacred objects, that they will be somehow salvific forces that will save us from our imperfections and possibly make us immortal.
Yeah.
The definition of idolatry is, I think I'm paraphrasing a theologian, Paul Tillich, here, but to take something that is of finite or limited value and treat it as if it were of infinite or utmost value. And so at Google, for example, Google recently brought on board someone named Ray Kurzweil, who talks in his writings and has been talking for years about the idea that what he calls the coming singularity will effectively give us the ability to merge with machines and become immortal. And so although he raises some cautionary notes, ultimately he paints a pretty positive utopian picture of our future and what technologies will bring for us. And of course, my suggestion is that the danger here is that when we engage in any kind of idolatry and treat something of finite value as if it were of infinite value, we can blind ourselves to the potential pitfalls and downsides of things like technology, whatever it happens to be. So that's what I mean by the potential pitfalls. Elsewhere in that chapter, I talk about some of the work of a media scholar at University of Virginia named Shiva Vaidyanathan.
Yes.
And he suggests that one of the potential pitfalls of this sacralization of technology is the sin of hubris or pride.
Right.
You can see that, for example, in Google's motto, "Don't be evil." Right? There's a sense that that in fact Google considers themselves incapable of being evil because their programming and their algorithms are so well managed and so rigorous and perfect that how could anything go wrong?
How could anything go wrong? Famous last words. Yikes. We're talking with Kevin Healy, assistant professor of media studies, about the media, about the power of the big guys. And as you point out about, you know, the mission of Google, don't do evil, organize the world's information and make it universally accessible. That's their mission. Sounds so much like a Christmas present from a generous Santa Claus. Yeah, they have this very benign, even benevolent image. How did they achieve that image? And what is the reality if it's not just organizing neutrally the world's information and making it universally accessible?
It's a very ambitious goal, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say.
And really, I mean, just think about it. The implications there. When they talk about organizing all of the world's information, that sounds like a good thing. Information is helpful. We should organize it so we can use it for education, for politics. But, you know, in this perspective, what I'm calling in that chapter the Californian ideology, the definition of information goes beyond that. And you can see this, for example, in Google's Street View initiative, where they've put cameras on top of cars, and the cars drive around and take pictures of panoramic pictures. Now, I've used this. It's very helpful in some situations. So, you know, I'm not being a Luddite here. I've used it in many situations. But think about this, how they're defining information. They're saying that information includes, in its definition, the image of you potentially standing outside of your home, for example. That's a bit of information, too. Well, if it's information, it should be collected, and it should be organized. That raises some interesting red flags. And in fact, people are quite aware of this, more so overseas than in the United States. As a matter of fact, when Google has sent some of its fleet of Street View cars in different countries like Japan and Great Britain and Germany, there were cases where people would literally hold hands across the street to prevent the cars from getting in there. Because what they were saying is essentially, yes, there is information here, but we own it. It's ours. It's not for you to collect and to organize as you see fit. It belongs to us. So it raises questions. It sounds like a good goal, but it should be a collective process and not one that is run by one very ambitious and potentially hubristic monopoly, essentially.
Yes, hubris. Boy, that always gets you into trouble. Yeah, I think hopefully people are aware of hubris, excessive pride, and thinking you can't go wrong, and you referred to a belief in what they call informationism, like sort of a new religion, as a route to social progress and personal happiness. Do companies like Google encourage such faith in informationism? And does this end up serving humans, or is it humans serving Google?
Right. That's kind of one of the issues that I know that you and Astra touched on Usually it's framed as, and I framed it in that chapter, as how we, in fact, are the products that Google is selling to advertisers, for example. I do think that, and this term informationism was discussed by the sociologist and theologian Jackie Lowell decades ago, this general idea of an over-reliance or a kind of a faith in information as a saving force. Right. But also more recently, if your listeners are interested in reading more about this, Quentin Schultz has written extensively on this on in a book called Habits of the High-Tech Heart. And yes, you know, there is a sense that we're being led to believe that information is the key to everything that we hold dear, to education, to politics, right?
Yeah, and just believing in the power of technology here to free us. And as you point out, the placing of technology, new technology, on a pedestal actually is not new at all. Andrew Carnegie, who the maker of steel, and Henry Ford, who used that steel to make cars, obviously, and mechanize everything, they had similar views. I'm actually reminded in reading your essay to hear the religious faith in the philosophy of logical positivism, which was popular just ahead of the disaster of the Great War, now known as the First World War. There was the belief that technological development was inherently good, inherently progressive. It was logical positivism. Is a version of logical positivism reborn in the faith that Google, by applying the principles of engineering, right, is more able to solve complex human problems than anybody else? So just, you know, this logic, just the simple principles of engineering, trust it. It's more able to solve evasive, elusive, complex problem, human problems.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have a quote in that chapter where someone asked a representative from Google, and I don't remember who exactly it was. They asked him, you know, should we consider regulating Google as a monopoly? Because essentially it does have a kind of monopoly status. And his response was that it's really not necessary to regulate Google because our engineering prowess is so sort of pristine and well-developed that, as I was saying earlier, there's not really anything ethically or morally that could go wrong here. We're developing a morally neutral and inherently benign system, and that engineering, you see in that a kind of faith in technological progress and engineering.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting about what you were saying before about earlier periods in American history, including you were mentioning Andrew Carnegie, that was also the period, you know, late 19th century, early 20th century, the so-called progressive era.
Right.
This is something I discuss with my students in a class called Media, Religion, and Culture. What's interesting about that is that at the time, you know, the business world was developing this sense that we can redeem humanity through the market and through technology and industrial development. And interestingly, many what we would consider today the counterparts of liberal or left-leaning Christian denominations, Protestants and evangelicals, really kind of jumped on that bandwagon, and many people in the so-called social gospel movement felt that, in fact, that they could redeem the marketplace by adopting some of the techniques of business and applying it within the realm of religion as well. And not surprisingly, I think, as it moved into the later parts of the 20th century, many of those evangelicals and Protestant groups began to feel that they had made a bit of a mistake.
We are talking with Kevin Healy about the effects of big Google-like things on our culture, on our humanity. And some of the words that you use, among other things, are techno-fundamentalism or cybernetic totalism. That's kind of scary. I mean, you talked about those things a little bit. I mean, it doesn't sound good. What are they talking about, some academic studies talking about techno-fundamentalism and cybernetic totalism?
Yeah. Well, those words, I would refer your listeners to someone named Jaron Lanier. And he's someone who is very well respected in Silicon Valley. He has established his name. He's still very active in technological research and development. He's worked for Microsoft, is affiliated with different universities doing research. This guy knows what he's talking about. He's an insider to technology. He was considered sort of the father or godfather of virtual reality technology. This is not some Luddite. And he is the one who cued me into, by his readings, including the book called You Are Not a Gadget, and then later he has another one called Who Owns the Future. He's the one who kind of cued me in his work, to this idea of cyber fundamentalism or cybernetic totalism. It's an ideology. It's a way of viewing the world that says, ultimately, the thing that we should be focused most on, because it has the most power to redeem our failings as human beings, is technology and engineering and information systems. And when you begin to go down that road and put your faith in technology itself, my concern is that we lose the focus on the human virtues of judgment. It is human judgment that is ultimately most important, of imagination, of relationship, of compassion. These human virtues kind of get a little bit nudged to the side. And I can, if you're, if you'd like, I can tell you a little bit of the back history of that ideological viewpoint.
Well, it does remind me of logical positivism, which also pushed aside those silly emotional kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm old enough to remember when Marshall McLuhan, I guess it was the late 60s, was a visionary peering into our great technological future. And you write that he was concerned about the tendency of the technological to discarnate, to cause humans to lose our sense of place and identity. You know, now you can communicate with anybody in an instant. Talk more about that discarnate idea.
Right, yeah, he was talking about, anybody who knows anything about Marshall McLuhan knows that he was a very sort of enigmatic and idiosyncratic figure. He's kind of a contentious figure within media studies. But what he's talking about there, I like his work because he's very humanistic in his approach. And he's concerned Yes. about the human being as a human being, our experience as embodied human being. We are in a body. We are born into a body. This body is going to die. What we need to be focused on is our embodied human experience. And what he's suggesting with the term discarnation is the idea that we can have a sense of being separated from our embodied self, and to be too focused on our virtual presence online or through cyberspace. Or now, of course, he was anticipating a lot of this. He was talking about television, radio, but he was right. anticipating a lot of the issues that even my students are dealing with right now. I get students writing about their sense of, not being able to distinguish between the real and the virtual in terms of their relationships, for example. That's what he was anticipating when he was talking about this idea of a discarnate life.
Hmm. Well, you can see it now. And I have two teenage daughters, and that's you spoke about that at a local junior high school. And, parents like me are concerned about such things as, obviously, possible addiction to smartphones and, at the very least, psychological distraction. And what you're talking about here is, there's a whole new world, that there's the virtual reality and the so-called reality and kind of mixing the two up. How is that, do you think, affecting all these teenagers who are just growing up with this stuff, and it's like these smartphones are welded to their hands.
Right, right. You know, and I don't blame them, really.
Oh, sure.
I guess I agree. I remember hearing Astra talking about this. Now, it's not as if we should point the finger at teenagers and say, you know, we older folks
that's not gonna
better
work. Right.
Than that.
Right.
You know, I have my smartphone right in front of me on the table here, you know, and I'll whip it out during class and remind people that I'm guilty of some of these things myself. But, you know, I find that every semester there's a group of students who want to talk about what they perceive as an emerging kind of addictive behavior among themselves and their friends towards mm-hmm. social media. And, you know, it's interesting because I don't put it on the syllabus. It's not coming from me necessarily. They come to me and say, this is the problem that I want to think through in my projects, for example. So they'll do things like they'll set up experiments where they'll ask their friends to stop using the phone for, you know, they'll ask them to do it for 24 hours, and they'll say, one of my friends was able to do it for 2 hours, and the other one was able to do it for 20 minutes, you know. And they're concerned about that. They don't like the fact that when they go to, you know, the dining halls here,
right.
that they're all staring at screen. Now, I want to be careful here because I'm not suggesting a kind of deterministic argument about technology. It's not technology itself that's drawing us in. I think it has to do with the commercial nature of the services and platforms that are currently being offered.
Yes.
And I'm going to put the word offered in scare quotes there, to us for our ongoing use. So, for example, you know, people are tending to, at least teenagers are tending to veer away from Facebook, for example, and go to Instagram or Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
But there's features on all of those social media sites that, you know, allegedly, I haven't seen them, but allegedly there's research studies indicating that, you know, when you go on Instagram or Facebook and you see that little red thing light up with a number in it, that's telling you that something that you just said was liked or commented on by a friend of yours, that there's a little release of dopamine in your brain.
My.
You know, it's like a sort of Pavlovian reaction. You know, they know this. I mean, social media companies know this. They know that we want to establish an identity online that we're proud of and that we want to go back and revisit and see who's liking our thing, you know. And it's a process that becomes habit forming.
Oh yes.
And it's difficult to break unless you put in place practices that can kind of break that pattern. And so I ask my students to sort of brainstorm what do you put in place of that?
Right. We'd all like to, I think, have. I mean, it's nice to have hundreds or thousands of friends on Facebook. It makes you feel good, and you're right. I can be talking with my kids, and, oh, I got so many likes here. That, in a way, it's like a substitute for flesh and blood. And, you know, when I'm just having a meal with somebody, and they're staring at their little machine, they're not being there with me. And you're right, we can't be Luddites. We can't smash the machines and go back. It's quite a challenge. Are your students finding new ways of coping with this problem that we're talking about here? This, you know, there's virtual reality versus so-called boring, you know, flesh and blood reality, and balancing them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting. Yesterday, one of my students was talking about just this very issue in an in-class presentation, and he's an athlete. And so I asked him, you know, I would imagine that the kind of interaction that you have with your teammates as an athlete is exactly the kind of face-to-face embodied interaction that's, you know, has a sense of authenticity to it, that is the contrast that we are seeking with regard to this virtual type of interaction. And he said, yeah, you know, to a certain extent that's true. Athletes benefit from being on, essentially being part of a community that's tight-knit, this kind of sense of shared value. You know, there's a parallels there to be made to traditional religious congregations, for example. That's the kind of organic formation of social ties and community that I think is very important. So, you know, he's aware of that, and people can sense the difference. On the other hand, you know, he pointed out to me that very often the coaches will have to intervene and say to an athlete who's sitting on the benches that he should not or she should not be tweeting about the game while the game is happening, you know? So it's always that constant temptation to negotiate between your, you know, potential genuine connection embodied with the person next to you and this very inviting, ongoing a virtual connection that social media invites us to engage in.
Yeah, it's so easy, and I'm reminded of back around the late 60s or so, there was a book called Be Here Now by Baba Ram Dass. It seems like kind of the opposite of being here now. It's being somewhere else now. it's so more fun, so much more fun. Well, I wonder if, you know, this is not a neutral, it appears to be a neutral, you know, server, search engine that's just providing information to us without any values to it, and that, you know, it's just up to us. But I wonder, you know, what happens when people are using this and doing it all the time? What happens to their individuality, perhaps, the values like creativity and democracy? It's commercial. I mean, Google is making a lot of money. They're like the new GM. They're really big. You know, they don't deliver objective, unbiased results. And of course, most people, like everybody, believes the information is accurate, that they're just unbiased. And in what ways does Google, the choices it gives, is it values neutral, or do our personal inquiries perhaps slant the information that we get? You know, they're not a neutral, just an algorithm.
Right. Yeah. This is a discussion that I always have in my classes, and there's a lot of scholarship on this issue. One of my mentors, Cliff Christians, interrogates this idea of whether technology is morally neutral. And he really kind of pulls it apart. It's very popular because it can, for example, in the case of the ongoing debates about gun laws, for example, it's a very useful argument. You know, it's not guns don't kill people, people kill people, right? And now, to a certain extent, that's true, but it's only half the story, and that's maybe being a little bit generous. I'd say maybe it's 10% of the story, right? I distinguish, for example, between what I'd call the functional neutrality of technology. That is, you could take a knife and use it to stab somebody, or you could take it to perform heart surgery on somebody. In that sense, the technology is morally neutral. On the other hand, there is what I call the ecological bias to any technology. Technology is always in some way disrupt existing moral and ethical systems or landscapes. A world with guns is a different moral universe. We face different moral questions than a world without guns. That is not incompatible with the idea that guns are functionally neutral, but if you just focus on the functionally neutral part, you're missing a big part of the story. And you're avoiding responsibility there. And this is the argument people are making about Google. You know, it sounds like All they're doing is developing code, and code is mostly, you know, sort of a glorified version of 2 plus 2 equals 4. You know, it just looks like a bunch of numbers. How could it possibly carry any kind of moral value or in it, right? But the presence, the increasing omnipresence of algorithms and engineered software, it fundamentally disturbs our moral landscape, so to speak. So, you know, we're dealing now with questions of what does it mean to be an authentic human being? You know, am I being authentic if I'm not sharing everything online? You know, Mark Zuckerberg has made statements about this. You know, he seems to think that if we don't share one kind of sense of unified self through social media, that we're being inauthentic, you know. So in that sense, you can see how new technologies they kind of find pressure points in our social and ethical systems along the lines of questions of authenticity or sincerity, these types of things. And they, you know, they call these things into question. We're having to deal with these issues in new ways.
Wow.
In that sense, they're not morally neutral. They're very disruptive.
And I wonder, just thinking about, there probably are some people who are not chained to the internet, and I can imagine people like Mark Zuckerberg and others saying, "What kind of a human are you?" I wonder if, you know, the political battles that have been going on since the founding of our country, the battle between right and left, between, you know, concentration and centralization of power and authority versus people like it at Shay's Rebellion, who wanted to have more local democracy and more local input into how decisions are made. If that continues in this new digital world, and you wrote that Newt Gingrich, who is obviously on the right, he puts a lot of faith in the digital world. He said he envisions a new world in which technology would do away with the need for bureaucratic oversight. Isn't that interesting?
That would be nice.
Yeah, right. Deregulation would free markets to become the engines of political and social change they were meant to be. It seems to me that it sounds like libertarianism fused with religious conservatism.
Right.
And what is that, and what is on the other side?
Oh, boy. Well, that is a tangled mess, isn't it?
It certainly is.
But it is. You know, it's interesting. I'm thinking about some of the kind of backstory there leading up to that moment where Newt Gingrich was, I remember a photograph of him looking at a laptop, you know, and being sort of, he gets once in a while that kind of childish grin on his face, you know, he's just delighted with what he's found and a new vision that he's eager to spread across.
This is radio, but I see the picture.
Right. You can picture it quite easily.
Yeah.
Leading up to that moment where he sort of, you know, converted to this cyber-utopian vision, it's an interesting backstory because it was this moment where religious conservatives sort of hitched their wagon to this emerging Californian ideology that sees technology as a kind of saving force. And it's interesting how they were very much compatible. You wouldn't think that they might be, considering that a lot of folks in Silicon Valley are not,
not religious fundamentalists.
Exactly, right? But possibly fundamentalists of a different stripe.
Oh, my. Yes, it's interesting. So what might be on the other side of this? You know, just total free market, let the free market rule, no regulations. That's, you know, libertarianism mixed with religious conservatism. Is there anything on the other side?
Well, you know, I think it's going to reach a sort of breaking point. And you can already see, and I think Astra sort of pointed to this a little bit too, that a lot of these companies have realized that they're going to face some significant pushback. I think this kind of ideology, this pie-in-the-sky techno-utopianism, is going to meet the hard reality of the voices of people on, living ordinary lives who are suffering from some of the ill effects of our emerging digital economy. you know, Facebook has dealt with that in very limited ways. When it rolled out its so-called Beacon program, there was a great user backlash against that. And, you know, users basically forced the company to reconsider its position. Beacon was a program, an initiative of Facebook where they decided essentially that if you purchased something, for example, on, this is a hypothetical, on Amazon, let's say I purchased a book as a wedding present for an anniversary present for my wife, that they would automatically display that purchase in my news feed to my friends, right, without my consent. Right? The people were not surprisingly upset about this because people don't want their consumer purchases, retail purchases, advertised to their friends without their consent. Right? So there's a huge backlash against that, and Facebook had to deal with that. And some of these other companies are dealing with similar types of backlash overseas now. I know that you and I briefly talked about this at the Rye Junior High. So as these companies are heading overseas and entering foreign markets, now they're having to deal with totally different perspectives on issues, for example, as privacy that are held by European countries and, you know, people steeped in a very different culture and way of thinking about privacy, for example. So, I think some of this is going to come to a head in the near future, and I have some hope that some of this cyber utopian ideology will meet the hard face of reality of people who are suffering at the end of the digital economy here. So I don't know. Do you share my hope there?
Well, I think there's starting to be some kind of a feeling for that, some kind of a sentiment along those lines. It hasn't not come even close to gelling yet, but there's, I mean, for years, you know, with Brave New World in 1984, looking at the big giant technological power, and then there's the common people. And what Zuckerberg was saying, well, if you don't, you know, share all your information, what kind of a person are you? But you're right. We all know that there can that this whole digital world is tied up very closely in spying on us and gathering. That's what it's about, gathering the information about us so that, as you said, we're not the consumers as much as we have become the products. How does that affect our sense of citizenship?
Yeah, you know, there was a good article, a little op-ed about that in the Wall Street Journal, maybe ironically, in the Wall Street Journal a few years ago about, and I think the title of it was, Why Aristotle Would Not Friend You on Facebook. And, you know, the thesis was something along the lines of how social media tends to commodify relationships. In other words, you know, I derive something from being connected to my high school friends online. Yeah, I have a Facebook profile, and sure, I stay connected to people.
And it's nice.
But it is a process of the commodification of relationships, and I think that's the key. It's again, it's not the technology itself, right, but it is the kind of assumption that we should allow technological development to proceed according to the logic of the consumer marketplace. And that's a fundamentally flawed assumption that we need to interrogate. And I think people are beginning to interrogate that. You know, one of my mentors that your guest mentioned, Bob McChesney, wrote a book with his colleague and friend John Nichols, where, you know, they said, you know, they're talking about the difference between, you know, socialism has become this sort of taboo word that's been linked up with the Obama administration and elsewhere, and to say, you know, if they've done surveys where they've asked people, you know, basic economic questions about the world that surrounds them, where essentially they're putting principles that would be considered socialist by any other, you know, say a comparable European nation, and an American public would tend to agree with them if they're not framed in the kind of negative tone that you would get from, you know, the Tea Party or Fox News. You know, people people do have a sense that there's something fundamentally flawed about a market-driven system where we see not only technology as sacred, but markets themselves as sacred.
Yes. Boy, that kind of sums up the what used to be considered the hard right, which is now basically the Republican Party, just to commodify everything, like turn the market completely loose and just let these inhuman market forces dictate our future. And it seems to be totally in line with the direction that things like Google and Facebook are really heading. And we talk about putting technology on a pedestal is not at all new. Well, there's another old idea, and that it was then called trust busting, which assumed that it was a good thing to break up monopolies, that monopolies are not good for humans. Is Google now not essentially a monopoly, and has it acted abusively as such as so many other monopolies before it have?
Well, some of the federal commissions in Washington have already decided that it has done so, although their gestures toward holding Google and other companies accountable would be considered, meager at best. But other countries around the world have, filed complaints or suits or passed, judgments against some of these companies. So, I'm sorry, your original question was...
Is Google essentially a monopoly, and can it be treated as such,
right,
perhaps?
Oh, right, yeah. I mean, I think there is an awareness that it is, if it's not already of a monopoly status, that it's at least approaching that. And, the other term would be oligopoly.
Oh, yes.
There's reasons why this is especially the case in the digital economy, and this is articulated very well by Bob McChesney in his most recent book, Digital Disconnect. So, among other reasons, there is something called network effects, which explains partly why a company like Google will essentially have monopoly control over the search industry, for example, the search engine industry, for example. And it's the idea that this works for social media sites like Facebook as well, is that the more people who are using one of these types of products, ostensibly the product will improve by the number of people who are using it. So the more people who are using one search engine like Google, the more it can adjust and refine its algorithms, collect information, and provide the best and most efficient, most relevant search results. And, people do this. It makes a lot of sense. Where else am I going to go besides Facebook?
Right.
Am I going to go to MySpace? I used to have a MySpace account, but nobody's there.
Right.
I've tried the decentralized nonprofit alternative Diaspora. I set up my account and poked around a little bit and didn't come back to it because everybody's on Facebook. So there's a general tendency in sort of the logic of networks toward monopoly. And so that's even more reason why we shouldn't be veering in the direction of deregulation and this kind of trust in the markets and technology, because there's even more a tendency today towards anti-competitive behavior.
Oh, absolutely. But don't we kind of need to? I mean, we had to rein in. I mean, the regulation was absolutely necessary back, 100 years or so ago, a little more than that, when Teddy Roosevelt did break up what were then called trust, that, it doesn't serve us well. I mean, we end up serving it. And that seems to be kind of a scary situation right now.
You would hope that there would be a kind of tension between these corporations and federal government and watchdog agencies, but this is something McChesney points out. Very often, there's a kind of you scratch my back, I'll scratch your back relationship.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of mutual benefits to be reaped. Many times, companies can profit, for example, by being paid to release certain amounts of data paid by law enforcement agencies. Mm-hmm. So they stand to make money off of government surveillance. And therefore, why would government intervene and curb or try to excessively regulate the efforts toward consumer surveillance? There's a kind of mutual relationship between consumer surveillance on the part of these for-profit companies and government surveillance on the part of, for example, the NSA. So it's difficult to disentangle those relationships.
Well, I think we somehow, it's challenging for sure, but that idea of the two working hand in glove here, and where are, the people, the citizenship, democracy and all this. If you just tuned in to the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is Kevin Healy. We're assistant professor of media studies at UNH. We're talking about the digital world, the power of Google, and just where humanity is and all that. And I got to read a little bit from your essay here. You say, Kevin, while the internet does not make us stupid, it does encourage certain types of cognitive skills and channels are intelligent along certain paths. And you say, we may lose our capacity for the type of deep processing required for mindful knowledge acquisition, inductive analysis, critical thinking, imagination, and reflection. As we spend more time online, we become more likely to rely on conventional ideas and solutions rather than challenging them with original lines of thought. What's happening with our humanity because of this process just described?
Yeah, there I'm drawing a little bit from the work of Nicholas Carr in his book, The Shallows.
Oh, yes.
Now, I know that his book has been a little bit controversial because people see him as too intensely skeptical. But even McChesney draws from his work. Essentially what he says is that our brains are plastic and that what we do habitually with our minds and with our bodies will cause new connections to be made and strengthened at the expense of old connections. And the research, there is research that he points to. This is not speculation. He's pointing to research, laboratory research, showing that when we habitually use, and primarily, this is the part that he leaves out, commercially developed and deployed technologies of this sort, the kind of cognitive work that we have to do is essentially trying to figure, our brain has to figure out what links to follow, what to pay attention to, what yes. not to pay attention to. It's a different part of the brain than we use when we're trying to do, for example, deep reading, where you sit in quiet with a book that is not going to respond to your touch. It's not going to serve you an advertisement. Mm. You're not going to be able to link to any other books. You're not going to be able to share it with your friends. They use different parts of the brain. And what he's suggesting for this, through this research is that the cognitive capacities that we need, that people like Jefferson, Madison were calling for as essential parts of a democratic character,
right.
what it means to be a democratic citizen,
yes.
is exactly that kind of deep thought and processing of reflection, of memory, of debate, of engagement with issues that are complex to do so over time, and that is one of my concerns with this kind of habitual right. use, and I see that in some of the ways that my students struggle with how to piece together a coherent essay.
Oh my, it's some scary stuff, and making things further scary in today's New York Times. Top of the fold, the principle that all internet content should be treated equally as it flows through cables and pipes to consumers looks all but dead.
Right.
Companies like Disney, Google, and Netflix will be allowed to pay internet service providers like Comcast and Verizon. Boy, they're getting small. I mean, they're fewer and fewer. For special faster lanes to send video and other content to their customers under new rules to be proposed by the FCC. Wow. That's big stuff, too.
This is not good.
No,
Bert.
This is not good. And I'm reminded, I love history, as everybody who listens to the show regularly knows. There once was an all-powerful institution which had as part of its mission to organize the world's information and was the source of knowledge which pretty much everyone had faith in and paid fealty to.
What was that?
the Catholic Church. Then came the Renaissance. I wonder, is there a Renaissance ahead? Are there any resemblances to the, right. Is it like the old super powerful Catholic Church, which was, there was all the knowledge in the world, and they were the organizers of it?
That's a great question. I like that question.
Thank you.
Do we still have a minute? Because,
oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, you might say that there's inklings of that, faint echoes of the coming Renaissance. There was another, I think it was a New York Times story, talking about how when you look in some urban centers, for example, and how people are attracted to sort of do-it-yourself, very organic types of activity. Like there's people learning how to churn butter. You know, mm-hmm. they're living in Brooklyn, but they want to know how to churn butter.
And do gardening.
You know, mm-hmm. all of these sorts of things. Now, there's only so much that's going to be accomplished at a systemic level by doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it just amounts to a level of coping. But it indicates a kind of broader concern for a return to something that's more authentic and organic. That could be the inklings of a kind of Renaissance. And there's an irony here, too, that there's another article about this recently in New York Times, might have been within the last year or so, that many of the employees at some of these companies, like Apple and Facebook, Twitter, right. Silicon Valley, have chosen to send their children to some relatively, compared to public schools, relatively expensive alternative schools like Waldorf schools that, guess what, do not allow technology in the classroom. So even within Silicon Valley, I think there's this kind of incipient realization that something is not quite right with the ideology that people at the top hold. And you can see some of that, too, in some of the conferences. They have these so-called Wisdom 2.0 conferences.
Mm.
And when you have people like, I don't know if you know the name Miriam Williamson, but she's a very known spiritual, motivational speaker and writer.
Oh, yes.
She's gone and talked to Wisdom 2.0. And when she turns this around in their face and says, you know, you're talking about mindfulness in the workplace, but what you need to be mindful of is the suffering caused by, you know, labor inequities, the externalization of issues like pollution and the degradation of privacy, you know, the explosions in Apple fact. These are the things that you need to be mindful of. And actually, I'm surprised when these contrary speakers show up there and the audience applauds. These are people who are employees of these companies, and they know that
they're
something
human.
Is not quite right.
Right.
So that you know, those things together, it's not the solution, but it might be indicative of what you're speculating as a kind of coming Renaissance. I hope you're right.
Well, it could be. And the idea that, you know, if everybody needs water and gas and electricity, they're regulated as a public utility. I can't help but think that it might be time to look at either municipalization or making these things a public utility, so that as one of the people you cite, I hope I say it right, Siva Vaidyanathan.
Vaidyanathan.
Fairly close. The idea of having a human knowledge project, as he calls it, an open, public, global, multilingual, and focused, just open stuff to serve the public good, information storage and retrieval as a public good, serving everybody.
Yeah, and it's the same argument along the same lines that McChesney and Nichols make in a book called The Death and Life of American Journalism, where they essentially say journalism is a public good as well, and therefore needs to be supported through public subsidies, essentially, of different, you know, they have different proposals for doing that, but it's the same idea.
We got to get it under control and serving us. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion. It will go on. I have a feeling we're at the beginning of, it could be a long and powerful discussion about the power of Google and the Internet. Thanks so much, Kevin Healy. If people are interested in following you, any suggestions you can make?
I'd be happy to receive the emails. You can look on not Google but DuckDuckGo.com and search for my name, Kevin Healy, and you will find my University of New Hampshire website, and you can find my email there.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Okay?
Thanks for having me, Bert. Really enjoyed. enjoyable conversation.
Well, thank you very much so. And I'm going to go out with a song by Bob Dylan, which was then about the power of the Catholic Church. Listen to the lyrics.
She's got everything she needs. She's an artist. She don't look back. She's got everything she needs. She's an artist. She don't look back. She can take the dark out of the nighttime and paint the daytime black. You will start out standing proud to steal her anything she sees. You will start out standing proud to steal her anything she sees. But you will wind up peeking through her keyhole down upon your knees. She never stumbles, she's got no place to fall. She never stumbles, she got no place to fall. She's nobody's child, the law can't touch her at all. An Egyptian ring, it sparkles before she speaks. She wears an Egyptian ring, it sparkles before she speaks. She's a hypnotist collector, you are a walking antique. Bow down to her on Sunday, salute her when her birthday comes. Bow down to her on Sunday, salute her when her birthday comes. For Halloween, buy her a trumpet, and for Christmas, get her a drum.